Last week we were commenting on the fourth shloka in the second volume. After great throes, she, that is the earth, cast off her old three and put on her new seven skins and stood in her first one. Now I realized that we were pointing out that because we are dealing with the fourth round, and I trust you're all with us on the fourth round, it's where we're supposed to be, that we then moved into a discussion of the various geological changes which have occurred, particularly during this fourth round. What concerns me is that, while I want to finish this because we got ourselves into it, is that then in a sense we are going to move back and see something of the beginnings, or at least the period that Jeffrey Barborka refers to as a period of dormancy, although I'm not really very happy with that term, because it is a kind of preliminary period in which what is dormant is not the earth, not the globe which we are occupying, but the life, the human life wave has, so to speak, not yet reached it. So one can say that is dormant. That is in a state of suspension, in a sense. So I hope it will not become too confusing that we keep moving back and forth. It may, but that's all right. Eventually you'll probably sort it out. I started to put something on the board to indicate that there, again, there are these correlations, and we have to keep that very clearly in mind. We've already talked about that, so we have to keep it in mind. But in order to complete the point where we were last week, we can note that these geological changes, which are the shiftings of the landmass, do have their correlation both in what we can the rounds, and now we're talking about simply the fourth round, and, as we already stated, in the races, and I keep putting that in quotes because of my feeling that it is not the accurate term so far as any racial evolution, it's conscious evolution. So we can begin to see these correlations all the time and have to keep that in mind, even though in the next shloka, shloka 5, we are going to go back to this very early period. But just to finish what we were speaking of, the first, of course, these changes HPB speaks of, this landmass as the imperishable sacred land, which is said to continue. Sometimes island is used, sometimes land, but she calls it the imperishable sacred land. Adivarsha, she uses the term in the Sanskrit. And Adi, remember, simply means first. So it is the first station, if you like. Varsha as a station. It, therefore, as she says, the only one whose destiny is to last from the beginning to the end of the Manvantaras throughout each round. Now that means it is always there. I do not feel, as I said last week, and I'll repeat it therefore, I do not feel that this is a specific geographical location on our planet, but rather it is the station which is permanent for the entire chain, and therefore has, as it were, its counterpart in terms of consciousness, that it is that which is always present. It is the vehicle which is always there, a place not specific geographically so much as specific for our humanity. It's a very difficult thing to explain, perhaps, that it is that it constitutes our entire globe, then, in whatever condition that globe may be, in accordance with the state of consciousness, and therefore the forms which are occupying it. To me, this is the only... I haven't seen this written anywhere. Maybe someday I'll have courage to write it up and then, you know, take all this flack that can be sent at me from around the world of how wrong I am, which doesn't really matter. But I think it makes sense, because it has to be a station, as it were, a state of our entire globe, which is always there, perhaps in its prototypical state, throughout the entire chain, throughout the entire all that happens. The second, you remember, we have already commented on, was the Hyperborean, as HBB calls it. The third, I think we had come to this, hadn't we, last week?
Yes.
The Lemurian. Again, in connection with this, we have to again be very clear. It's the third geological shift. We are coming into the kind of physicality that can be historically verified. For now, of course, it's in this third developmental stage that humanity does enter into a denser form, as we see when we move to Shloka 12. And that's why I say, I hope you won't get confused, because we have shlokas 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, you see. But this is where perhaps Ashish in Man, Son of Man, in the renumbering of the shlokas has been helpful. But I'm still going to follow HPB's numbering, even though it may throw us at times. But this is the third developmental stage. The name Lemuria, as of course HPB tells us, was the invention of a man by the name of P.L. Sclater, who asserted sometime between 1850 and 1860, and so you can see this was fairly recent when HPB was writing The Secret Doctrine, on zoological grounds, the actual existence in prehistoric times of a continent which extended from Madagascar to what is now Sri Lanka and Sumatra. The extent of this is further described as including some portions of present-day Africa and stretching from the Indian Ocean to Australia. Two good friends here from us, well, three of course, but two who have just arrived, so the Australian contingent is getting rather heavy. But I always recall walking in the gardens in Sydney, over near Government House. What are they called? The Botanical Gardens, aren't they? These friends are from Sydney, so they'll remember. And coming on this very ancient tree, I mean, I'm sure it's a tree that is it called the blood tree? Or it's a, you know, it has a red sap, very, very red sap.
Red gum.
Hmm?
Red gum?
Yeah, well, it wasn't really a red gum. They said it was something else that is there. I was with Ruth Berenger, and we were in Audrey Goddingham. And it's a very, very ancient, and it doesn't look like any of the gums. But that it had, and I, you know, I suddenly had this awful feeling standing there, you know, as though it was a kind of ancestral memory that prodded me deep inside, that this was from Lemurian times, you know.
Bushes underneath, if you touch them,
they curl up. And there's a, yes, there's
animal.
They're almost animal, and you feel that you're really thrust back somehow in a kind of ancestral memory. It's a huge trunk, very huge trunk, and it seemed to me the common name was just blood tree or something like that, because it really looked like it oozed blood, you know. It was really a very strange, and of course I think that it doesn't exist. I don't. It's one of the things we didn't bring over here. We brought some of the eucalyptus, as you've probably noticed. We have some here. But that, I'm glad we didn't transplant. But it has a very peculiar feeling. And one feels, therefore, that there are these places on the continent, on the Earth's surface today, these continental land masses that are very, very ancient. And I'm sure that this is true. In fact, today geologists know this. Much of this land mass is said today to be submerged beneath the Pacific Ocean. And HPB says in a footnote on page 8 that this continent is pre-tertiary. Now, I think, and as I've already suggested, that with the geological changes from this period onwards, about the middle of this period, that is, in terms of the root races, about 3.5, about the midway point of the third developmental stage, when the physicality is much more established than it was in these earlier ones, you see, obviously, corresponding with the early rounds, early root races, physicality as we know it, was not yet there. From that time on, there is evidence, certainly, of major shifts in the land masses on our globe. But today, as we well know, and I'm not at all a geologist, but just reading what is available to the layperson, as we know, there's a suggestion that portions of what are called the tectonic plates, which constitute those land masses, simply broke away and reassembled themselves as floods, volcanoes, earthquakes, and other natural disasters affected the planet. Some may be submerged, but others may simply still be present. And so it is, as we know, there are portions of our present land masses that are very much older geologically than other portions. And, for example, just recently it has been found that there's a land mass in Idaho, the state of Idaho, in our northwest, that geologically is the same as portions of the land mass of Alaska, but not similar to other immediately adjacent portions of the land mass. And if any of you have ever driven through Idaho, as I expect some of you have, remember that fascinating area known as the Craters of the Moon. George and Dulcie probably have been up through there, haven't you? I don't know. And it's absolutely different, isn't it, from any surrounding formations in that immediate vicinity. And it does indeed, you feel like you're walking out on the moonscape. It's an absolutely amazing place. You suddenly come upon it. This whole area, which is black, which is volcanic, of course, in which there is the lava flow has been suddenly stopped. And I'm told that if you go way down, as geologists do, take a core, that the whole structure, the whole geological stratification is very, very different from other areas in the state. So it's this sort of thing now may show us that we can, in traveling around, stand on land masses that are technically, from one point of view, Lemurian or Atlantean and so on. This is true. So I think we have to rethink or at least reinterpret much of our former thinking about these ancient continents, that the entire continent may not be, as it were, submerged, but that there can be pieces that have floated around. And this, of course, is contemporary geological thought. Well, as we know, the fourth continental land mass has been called Atlantis, and the very interesting thing, as HPB of course states, it would be the first historical land were the traditions of the ancients to receive more attention. She tells us, and this is page 606 of volume 2, that Atlantis is the fourth continent that appeared, but the third that disappeared. Now that's true because this imperishable sacred land did not disappear. So it is still there, present. It's said there, of course, that the famous island which Plato described was a fragment of Atlantis after some of the cataclysms had sunk most of the continent. And HPB says further in regard to Atlantis, this again is volume 2, pages 333-334, the Atlantic portion of Lemuria was the geological basis of what is generally known as Atlantis. The latter, indeed, must be regarded as a development of the Atlantic prolongation of Lemuria, then as an entirely new mass of land upheaved to meet the special requirements of the fourth root race. So in a sense, what she's hinting at is what we already know is true in the tectonic plate theory. But it wasn't known at her time. So it's interesting. But she's trying to express at that time something that is now much more easily expressed in light of present of contemporary geological theories. But note, to meet the special requirements of the fourth root race, so that the land we occupy, the portion of the globe, is, as it were, it has its relationship, it has its magnetic link with the kind of development that is to take place on it. One can use a very interesting theory in regard to speech to perhaps illustrate this. There is a theory current with regard to the development of language, that language or speech, not simply not written language, but verbalized, spoken language, has it takes its character from the landscape. And that people who live, for example, in mountainous areas have a much greater range of inflection than people who live on the plains. Rather interesting theory of speech and the development of speech. And this is a current theory that speech indeed is related to, I always think of Swiss yodeling, you know, which you know sounds like the Alps themselves, if you're, doesn't it? You say so
requires
that
requires a description.
Yes.
To do the description.
Yes, and you know, I think some of the most, if I may say so, unpleasant accents in the United States, I won't go anywhere overseas, is the Midwest flat, absolutely flat language that you get in our good old Midwest, you know. You know, it doesn't have the lilting quality. You know, and you know, the lilting quality of the Irish and the Scots, the Highland Scots.
I've never heard
in the Welsh.
I've never heard that Midwest accent. What I do notice as a foreigner is Bronx and New Jersey.
Yes, yes, you get the Bronx and New Jersey and the nice nasal accent, and you know, of course, I mean, that's, they all close their noses, you know, naturally. But this is an interesting sort of thing that maybe an illustration of this very statement that the mass of land upheaved to meet the special requirements of the fourth root race. So that a stage of consciousness is related to the condition of the earth, of the land. And there is, therefore, this development. Now, HPB continues in this reference, their continent, that is the Atlantean continent, was formed by a coalescence of many islands and peninsulas which were upheaved in the ordinary course of time and became ultimately the true home of the great race known as the Atlanteans. In Isis Unveiled, HPB, in volume 1, page 558 of Isis, says, at different epochs of the past, huge islands and even continents existed where now there is but a wild waste of waters. At a remote epoch, a traveler could traverse what is now the Atlantic Ocean almost the entire distance by land, crossing in boats from one island to another where narrow straits then existed. Well, this, of course, is well known. There have been the shiftings of these land masses, sometimes beneath the ocean, sometimes above. But in essence, then, suited to the stage of consciousness of the peoples. This, of course, is what has brought us to the Ojai Valley, because our state of consciousness is soaring so high, we had to be on a piece of land that is so really beautiful, you say. Isn't it true? And, you know, I mean, the whole tradition of this valley, which gives us, interacts with us. I mean, one is one's better self, maybe, here in Ojai. Diana, would you agree?
Yes.
You see? And,
and also Santa Barbara.
Oh, I guess. All right, we'll have to include Santa Barbara. But this is why Jean and John come up from Los Angeles, isn't it? To enjoy the.
A little part of La Moria. It's a little part of La Moria.
Down in Los Angeles, yes.
Just one little slice of one up like that.
Yeah.
San Francisco and La Jolla.
That's right.
I heard that in San Francisco, really.
Oh, good. Well. So now you know, you see, it depends where you are. Well, of course, HPB names the fifth continent America, but by which she does not mean, and this, you see, begins to give us a certain clue to what is meant by these terms, because she says, as it is situated at the Antipodes, it is Europe and Asia Minor, almost coeval with it. So we're not talking simply about the United States. We're talking, therefore, about land masses that are conducive to and correlate with the consciousness evolving at this particular time. The very fact that she says it's that it is Europe and Asia Minor as well as the land mass we occupy here. And she says, if the Indo-Aryan occultist teaching followed the appearance of the continents in their geological and geographical order, then this classification would have to be altered. But as the sequence of the continents is made to follow the order of evolution of the races from the first to the fifth, our Aryan root race, our fifth, Europe must be called the fifth great continent. But it's the Europeanization of the globe that is referred to. And this is what has really occurred, is it not? So she says, the secret doctrine takes no account of islands and peninsulas, nor does it follow the modern geographical distribution of land and sea. So it's very clear that we're not talking simply about some geographical locations, but rather the condition of the globe at a particular time. Since the day of its earliest teachings and the destruction of the great Atlantis, the face of the earth has changed more than once. There was a time when the delta of Egypt and northern Africa belonged to Europe, before the formation of the Straits of Gibraltar, and a further upheaval of the continent changed entirely the face of the map of Europe. The last serious change occurred some 12,000 years ago and was followed by a submersion of Plato's little Atlantic island, which he calls Atlantis after its parent continent. In one of the famous question and answer letters from the Master K.H. de Sinnott, the Master writes of the overlapping of continental masses and the sinking and upheaval which bring about new continental configurations. And this, in a sense, is equated then with the overlapping of stages of consciousness, or what we call the great root races. Just as there is an overlapping of stages of consciousness, so there is an overlapping of continental masses. This is in the Mahatma Letters, page 151 of the second edition. I'm sorry I don't have the reference in the third edition. And I didn't even put down, I'm sorry, the letter that it's from. That's dreadful of me, but Virginia and George are here, and they're the experts that can always tell me what letter it's in. I know, it's one of the question and answer letters, and they go on forever. Anyway, let me just read this portion. In the Eocene age, even in its very first part, the great cycle of the fourth race men, the Atlanteans, had already reached its highest point. And the great continent, the father of nearly all the present continents, showed the first symptoms of sinking, a process that occupied it down to 11,446 years ago. Now, I guess we have to add a little over 100 years, because this was written probably 1882, 83, along in there, when its last island went down with a crash. Lemuria can no more be confounded with the Atlantic continent than Europe with America. Both sank and were drowned with their high civilizations and their gods. Yet between the two catastrophes, a short period of about 700,000 years elapsed, Lemuria flourishing and ending her career just at about that trifling lapse of time before the early part of the Eocene age, since its race was the third. Why not admit, true, no one of them has ever thought of it, that our present continents have, like Lemuria and Atlantis, and the master puts these names in quotes, been several times already submerged and had the time to reappear again, and bear their new groups of mankind and civilization, and that at the first great geological upheaval, at the next cataclysm, in the series of periodical cataclysms that occur from the beginning to the end of every round, are already a top-sized continents will go down, and the Lemurias and Atlantises will come up again. Now, I think there's much to think about in this. Of course, the Master further states that the last seventh sub-race of the sixth root race of present mankind will be flourishing on, quote, Lemuria and, quote, Atlantis, both of which will have reappeared. So, the continental land masses appear and disappear, but are always related to the stage of consciousness of those who inhabit the land masses.
Do you think it had to go through a purification?
I think so. I think I think one has to see this from that point of view, that the land gets washed clean, that this is reincarnation for a continent in a sense, and that the seeds are always present, but within the land its own memory, just as within us there is the racial memory or collective unconscious of Jung, if you like. This memory, this ancestral memory, is there, and it can be reawakened, and is present. Now, we'll see this, I think, very clearly when we come to the next shlokas, because what we see is the earth attempting to bring about the production of a humanity, which it's not able to do without some assistance. And we'll see this. But it produces it out of the seeds, the remains, as indeed it's called that, the remains of previous rounds. Rather interesting. And we do the same things, I think we can show. We always feel we have to use what is within us, what we have to create. And this is an interesting, well, I'm sort of get jumping ahead, but we'll see this. Now, the virtually no information then is given to us about the continental land masses as they will be in the sixth and seventh root races, in other words, towards the end of the present fourth round. But will they then become less physical in one sense? Just, in other words, sort of, this is the central point, Atlantis, so the sixth and seventh? I mean, frequently we get this, that the California, Southern California, Australia, New Zealand, this is the area for the next major developmental stage. South America, perhaps, of the seventh developmental stage. One can theorize, one can begin to see that wherever it may be, the land itself has to have certain characteristics that both help the consciousness and are related to the consciousness of the beings inhabiting it. It's a very interesting study and a very interesting area to investigate. I recall and some of you have heard me mention this, my trips to South America, particularly the wonderful occasion when with friends we traveled up through the Andes and up to some of the land that is so sacred, was so sacred, of course, to the Incas. This marvelous feeling that in one sense one was looking at the future, not only the past. I think I've referred to that. Again, these are my own feelings, my own internal reactions. I was quite unprepared for it, I can say that. I had no idea that it would have that kind of effect upon me when we climbed Sun Island in Lake Titicaca, and the whole range of the mountains are there before you, you know, this marvelous range. Can't even think of the names of name
the
them. The Andes, yes, thank you. The whole range of the Andes, and high up on Sun Island, which tradition says is where the first Inca his sister wife came and were given the rod of power and told to go, and where it sank into the earth would be the seat of empire. And of course it sank into the earth at Cusco, which was indeed the central part of the Inca Empire. But suddenly there, looking at the Andes and then traveling by train, that wonderful train trip from Puno to Cusco through the Andes, this feeling that not only was this the past, but here was the future, here was a land that responded in some very special way to the future. Really amazing. So perhaps we have to, we do something with the land. And of course we know this from just the very simple fact of all of the ecological studies. We change the face of the earth, don't we? Man does. We have this tremendous capacity to denude forests and to mine the seas and everything else, and we change, therefore, the face of the earth. And what do we do with it? What is our responsibility then? Is it in accordance with our consciousness? Will it, in other words, will we, like Lemurian Atlantis, have to then sink because our consciousness has moved down? Or will it indeed be more greatly purified? These are the questions. And I think this helps us to realize our responsibility towards the land. Well, now that, remember, is within the fourth round, and so it seats us again, it places us again. But now, suddenly, the secret doctrine returns to an earlier stage, preliminary to the fourth round. And so HPB calls the next section, which he calls stanza two, but you will recall from my early comments that we are not now so concerned with the stanza number as with the shloka numbers, because she is numbering the shlokas consecutively now. But it's interesting that she includes under this particular section shlokas 5 through 10, although the ones that we want to look at very specifically first are 5, 6, and a part of 8. Barborka quite rightly points out that the entire section reads very much like a myth, and indeed Ashish points this out also, that now in one sense we are reminded of many, many ancient myths. What is given us is a remarkable picture of the way in which nature, the earth, without any inner direction, without the awakening of other principles to come to her aid, simply cannot produce a higher order. Throughout the shlokas, of course, in this whole series in anthropogenesis, we find quite a distinction from much of contemporary thought in science. The esoteric tradition is very clearly that aid is provided to the human kingdom, so that we may say that Ant-Man is in his physical outer form the result of the evolutionary drive mineral, vegetable, animal, and even in his psychic nature participates in these earlier stages, which we can also equate, incidentally, with the alchemical stages, as Stephen Heller is doing on Thursday evenings. But that there is a plus which makes all the difference, of course. At every stage, at least up to the present, and we'll note this change in due course of our studies, assistance has been provided. But the interesting thing, I think, is to note the efforts, therefore, at each stage for that which is present to produce the next stage. That effort is required, and only when it has gone to the limit of the effort, as it were, does it call down a higher stage to help it. One can call this the influx of grace, if you like. One can call it whatever, however you want to approach it. But it's as though every effort must be made in order to attract the higher principles that will then enable it to go forward. And we see this. The importance is very much of this assistance is emphasized in the shlokas, which point out that without that assistance, nature simply by herself cannot bring about a conscious being, a manasic being. That is, the mind cannot be present without some other awakening. So we have this marvelous statement, Shloka 5, which is very early in the Earth's history, very, very early in the fourth round. As I say, Barborka in Peopling of the Earth calls it the period of dormancy, but it's dormancy only in the sense that the higher beings have that human life wave has not yet entered into habitation of the globe. The wheel whirled for 30 crores more. Marvelous. It constructed rupas, soft stones that harden, hard plants that softened. I think it's a marvelous picture. Visible from invisible, insects and small lives. She, that is the earth, and note the earth is always feminine, Gaia, the Gaia principle. She shook them off her back whenever they overran the mother. After 30 crores of years, she turned round, she lay on her back, on her side. She would call no sons of heaven, she would ask no sons of wisdom, she created from her own bosom, she evolved watermen terrible and bad. Now, remember that this follows upon those early shlokas when there is indeed a plea, a real plea from the earth, in which the earth is calling that in a very real way for assistance. You remember, we have this in the shlokas 2 and 3 particularly, in which there is this calling for some assistance to be given. Said the earth, Lord of the shining face, my house is empty. Send thy sons. So in one sense, the earth has made the appeal. Now, I feel there are probably here some shlokas omitted that sort of run like this. You see, said the Lord of the Shining Face, I shall send thee a fire when thy work is commenced. I think there's something missing here in which the sun said, look, you do everything you can first. I mean, this is not a translation from any censor, it's just my own made-up sort of version. But saying, in effect, I'll help you out, but you've got to make the effort first. And isn't that always the law of life, in one sense? You see, I'm not going to do it for you. And I'm not going to just because you say, look, my house is empty, find me some tenants to pay the rent, you know, so I can meet the mortgage here. The sun, the Lord of the Shining Face, says, well, you go out and look for some tenants yourself. See what you can find. And then, if you can't get very far, I'll help you. But we will see in due time, not today, because I know we won't get to it today, that also what is later awakened is, as it were, the future. This is a thesis that I have been developing, which I'm quite convinced that we are as much made of by the future as of the past, and indeed we can change the whole focus and see that it is the future that does bring us into being. But for the moment we have to, I won't get into that because you may want to argue that. It is in a sense now that all of these are present, and this in one sense is all that the globe has to work with, is what has happened. Therefore, the effort that is made. The time periods, of course, are enormous. And again, I think we mustn't be too caught up in time, but it's rather interesting that some figures are given to us, and of course, in the secret doctrine, very soon we come on the whole chronology of the Brahmins, as it's called. This is in connection with Shloka 10. So it's still in this section. But I think we have to be very, very careful. All we can say is that enormous periods of time are referred to. The wheel whirled for 30 crores. Now, HPB says in a footnote that this refers to three occult ages, or 300 million years. Well, it's a staggering amount, sort of like our national debt. But while that is an actual figure, I think we have to be very careful, because the present calendar that we use was not in effect 300 million years ago. I mean, we have to admit this, that really it's only within the last century and a half that our present calendar has been accepted all over the world. So, you know, we're really dealing, you know, what is a year? So be cautious. True, 1 crore is 10 million, or it's 100 lakhs, L-A-K-H-S. A lakh is 100,000. I had to learn this when I was vice president at ADYAR and dealt with the budget. And the financial statements are naturally in these figures, you see. So, you know, you talk about a lakh of rupees or a crore and so on.
What's a crore?
A crore is 10 million rupees. 1 crore is 10 million rupees. Now, the...
$1 million, 10 lakhs.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So, now, the point that we notice is that the whirling for 30 crores is 30 crores more. Now, the entrance of the word more indicates that that is in addition to previous whirlings. I was just reading back last night in the journal Science 86, and I'm not sure which month it was. It must have been, I guess it's this month, March, April, I think. I guess it comes out to something. Anyway, a very interesting small article that a couple of scientists who have been studying just a very small fraction of the sky, you know, this is a 10-year study, and they're just focused on one little small portion, have concluded or come up with a thesis that the entire cosmos is composed of bubbles. Something we could have told them a long time ago, you know, but anyway, they didn't listen to us. I think CWL was the first to use the term bubbles in Koilon, wasn't he? Anyway, we have bubbles out there. Anyway, what they are theorizing from their observations, you see, is that it's all bubbles, and therefore there is another force primary to gravity, which of course HPB said, of course, you know, 100 years ago, also in the Secret Doctrine, a force that, in other words, tends to sphericity. That is, a bubble is spheroid. Now, I think this is quite incredible. I almost rushed in and woke up Virginia to tell her, but I figured she'd read this, so she already knew. Oh, she was already awake. Well, yes, she told me she was awake, yeah. She told me this morning she was awake, but I didn't know it then. But I think this is extremely interesting, you see, that this whirling, and you'll remember when we studied, those of you who've been brave enough to stick with me through all of these innumerable sessions we've had, when we spoke of the whirling gyration, the circumgyrations of Fohat, that by its very nature, it is circular. Of course, Fohat runs circular errands, you see. So it tends to a sphericity. That are, and of course space is curved, what else could it be? I mean, you're not going to get rectangular blocks in spherical space. Space, or curved space, you see. Although, I mean, there are some blockheads among us, perhaps, speak for myself, but in any event, the principle of sphericity, the rotundness of Plato, appears to be a primary force. And here are scientists even suggesting that this is a primary force even before gravity. So, the whirlings, that all came out of this term whirling, but it is a whirling that therefore is, in this sense, spherical, spiral, circular, however you want to express it. It's a very graphic term to describe today the revolution of the globe itself. Now we can take the entire subject, of course, as describing literally the early stages in the formation of this globe, Globe D, Earth, prior to the arrival of the human kingdom, or we can take it symbolically, as indeed Ashish does. So, for example, when we learn that the mother, which is the living earth, Gaia, and I think it's so interesting that today this whole emphasis on the Gaia principle has come up again in consciousness, and we're aware of the livingness of our planet, very much aware of the livingness. When that turned around, the movement can indeed refer to the turning point at the bottom of the cycle, where the outrushing energies begin to turn back towards their source. And therefore, we are not dealing with a spatial movement, if you want to see it in symbolic terms. The turning of the cycle is a symbolic way of expressing a change in inner or psychic attitude. And this indeed is what has come about, even in recent years, in our whole attitude, isn't it? Much more of an emphasis on the psychic attitude, the inner attitude. For example, Ashish, if we continue this symbolic interpretation, Ashish points out, page 83 of Man, Son of Man, from the moment the physical level is established in outwardness, the separate forms which arise in an ascending series are reaching up to feel, know, and understand the source from which they came. Well, now we're really given only a very few hints about the condition of the earth in the earlier rounds, but perhaps it's useful to note what we are told about the earth in these rounds, because it's from the remains of these that at the beginning of the fourth, the globe is attempting to bring forth human beings, bring forth man, to bring forth a sentient, self-conscious being. In volume 1 of The Secret Doctrine, page 259, we have a very brief reference to the condition of the globe in the first round. Just a brief reference. Thus, she says, in the first round, the globe, having been built by the primitive fire lives, that is, formed into a sphere, had no solidity nor qualifications save a cold brightness, nor form nor color. It is only towards the end of the first round that it developed one element which from its inorganic, so to say, or simple essence became now in our round the fire we know throughout our system. The earth was in her first rupa. And so we have in the first round the element principle of fire. We've already talked in previous sessions about the tattvas and the relation to these primary elements. Not fire as we know it, but the principle underlying it. So that begins to develop, emerge. HPB tells us in a footnote in volume 1 on page 252, the earth, such as we know it now, had no existence before the fourth round, hundreds of millions of years ago, the commencement of our geological earth. The globe was fiery, cool, and radiant as its ethereal men and animals during the first round, says the commentary, luminous and more dense and heavy during the second round. So then we have a very brief reference to the condition of the second round. This is volume 1, page 260. From the second round, earth, hitherto a fetus in the matrix of space, began its real existence. It had developed individual sentient life, its second principle. And so, in that sense, we have air, representative, if you like, of jiva or prana. In individual sentient life, which is jiva, prana, air, the element of air. Not self-conscious life. No, not at all. Thank you very much, David, yes. Now, even less, of course, is given to us about the third round. If you think that wasn't very much about the second, even less is given about the third round, although a commentary describes it as watery. This would be quite natural. And so you can guess what is the element of the fourth round. Yeah, naturally. What else? So you get the element principles, the tattvas, if you like. So, but again, not water as we know it in the third round. Later, however, HPB quotes from a commentary regarding the cataclysms that have occurred in past ages. It's a very mysterious passage in many ways, and for that reason probably is all the more interesting. I think the more mysterious some of the things she gives us, the more interesting they are. She quotes first from a stanza. This is volume 2, page 312. If you always try to give you the references because I think they're helpful. She says it's a stanza. It's not one in the series, not one of those that's numbered, but it is rather in a section which she refers to as the primeval manus of humanity. And she says, may the surface of the earth may be inferred from this stanza. So it's not, in other words, one of the shlokas that is in this numbered series. During the first 7 crores of the kalpa, 70 million years, the earth and its 2 kingdoms, mineral and vegetable, one already having achieved its 7th circle, the other, hardly nascent, are luminous and semi-ethereal, cold, lifeless, and translucid. In the 11th crore, the mother, Earth, grows opaque. And in the 14th, which is where we are, the throes of adolescence take place. Well, generally, by the 14th year of the child, of the young person, you really are in the throes of adolescence, aren't you? Is that right? Well, I know that, but I speak for yourself, of course. But isn't that right? I expect Cecily and David have just been through this with their daughter. Not too many years ago. What is Felicity now? 18. Well, you see, she's getting at the edge of the throat, but yes, all right. These are very good friends from Australia, Cecily and David Dines, those of you who haven't met them. So in the 14th, the throes of adolescence take place. These convulsions of nature, geological changes which we've already just talked about, that have gone on, last till her 20th crore of years, uninterruptedly, after which they become periodical and at long intervals. Isn't that a marvelous passage? Then HPB adds to it, the last change took place nearly 12 crores of years ago, but the earth, with everything on her face, had become cool, hard, and settled ages earlier. And then HPB also adds commentary, thus, if we are to believe esoteric teachings, there have been no more universal geological disturbances and changes for the last 120 millions of years, and the earth was, even before that time, ready to receive her human stock. So this is all within the first 3 rounds. But she adds further, we have to note this, again, this is continuing pages 312, 313 of volume 2. The appearance of the human stock in its full physical development took place only about 18 millions of years ago, after the first great failure of nature to create beings alone, without the help of the divine fashioners, had been followed by the successive evolution of the first three races. The actual duration of the first 2.5 races is withheld from all but the higher initiates. The history of the races begins at the separation of the sexes, when the preceding egg-bearing and androgynous race perished rapidly, and the subsequent sub-races of the third root race appeared as an entirely new race physiologically. So these, we also have to see, are in a sense repeated in the root races. There is a correlation, again, with these. And it's at this 3.5 point in Globe D that the humanity, the physiological humanity as we know it, plus the entry of the divine fashioners, the Manasaputras, occurs. So as we read this passage, we recognize that she's moved very swiftly into the conditions present in our fourth round, our present cycle. But as I've just said, following the law of analogy, we have to assume that there was a similarity in conditions of the first three stages of consciousness of this fourth round and the first three rounds. And this is further borne out by HPB's insistence that at every stage forward, there is a recapitulation of previous stages. At every stage, we recapitulate the past. We know, of course, that this is true biologically. The embryo recapitulates in the womb earlier stages of development, physiologically, of the entire species. Well, we have to introduce here another concept, which I hope will not be too confusing, but may help us to see that while only hints and fragments are given to us regarding these early stages, these first three rounds, and even the earlier developmental stages of this fourth round, we have the memory of these experiences within us, because we are the result of that. And we are also the result. This is where I come back to this remembering the future. We remember not only the past, we remember the future. We put it together, which is to remember. And the future, in one sense, consists of all that has achieved a certain status and returns or incarnates in us as the Manasaputras, you see, the divine fashioners. And we put together, this is the uniqueness of the fourth stage, is that we remember past and future in the present. It's a profound statement. It's almost worthy of the secret doctrine. But you begin to see how this fits together so magnificently. Now, I must use analogy then, again, as the basis for this statement. But HPB quotes what she calls the commentaries, which are the occult records, we can only assume refers to an occult work with which she's familiar. Every now and then she says, as the commentaries say, you see. She quotes it to the effect that no Dhyani Chohan, even the highest, can realize completely the condition of the preceding cosmic evolution. The Manus, that is, those with minds, retain a knowledge of their experiences of all the cosmic evolutions throughout eternity. This is page 310 of volume 2. It's a most thought-provoking statement, and I think it indicates to us by analogy that we, or at least the consciousness within us, must retain in memory all experiences through which that consciousness has passed. In many ways, we repeat the experience in our lives. And it's a point which can be explored further. I mean, there are those who remain forever at the mineral stage. They are so crystallized, you can get nothing into them. Right? And our very language, as I've said on other occasions, and many of you know I have a love affair with language, our very language repeats this, remembers it for us. The very fact that I can say there are those with crystallized minds indicates both the hardness and stability and the luminescence, because some people with crystallized minds have very luminous minds. You think? You know. And we have people who are vegetables, not just vegetarians, but who vegetate. And our language has a great deal of animalistic metaphors within it. There are really very few metaphors in our language. And I use the term metaphor, even though Stefan is not very happy with, but I think it's a beautiful word. There are very few metaphors in our language for purely human and even less for divine qualities. Have you ever considered this? This is the memory of earlier rounds and earlier root races, which is present within us, and our language reflects it. So I call this to your attention. Now, this isn't to say we don't say that a person looks like a god, Apollo-like, or whatever, but I'm talking about actual metaphors that we use are generally drawn from the past. It's a very interesting thing to explore, something that I've been thinking about as a result of working out these correspondences. Perhaps we should. But the interesting thing, I think, is that then valuations are given. These watermen, for example, are not simply terrible. They are bad. Now, whose valuation is this? Whose valuation is this? Does the earth herself, and we'll look at this more in detail next week, recognize that there is a certain moral sense lacking in what she can produce? Rather interesting. Is there, in other words, not a self-conscious awareness, but a kind of conscious, sentient feeling? Why wasn't it just watermen that are terrible?
bad for survival in a whole sense, isn't it? I mean, if the earth itself was a big hole, Father created watermen, and they were bad for his survival as a whole.
Yeah.
And she could live there.
But how would the earth know that they were bad?
Survival.
All right. How did
some cosmic survival is against that kind of production. However, the possibility was there, so she brought it forth. And therefore we found out that survival meant elimination of that or some other way. So then she changed into putting together mineral and vegetable to make an animal to make the fourth round. That's how she found out.
It's interesting, yes.
The learning process is the... If you're going to compare it to a teenager, you know, that is the learning process.
Yes, because Earth is adolescent, you see. In her, she's really going through a very difficult time.
But she asked for help, though.
But she had asked for help, you see.
She didn't feel that there was something like
that. That's right. So she had asked for help.
Didn't any wonder that evolution takes such an absolutely inconceivable time because of this colossal struggle that's had to go on from the beginning? I get a sense of this terrible struggle that
the Earth is having. Yes, you do. You really do. I have the greatest sympathy for Earth at this stage. The greatest sympathy. Anybody who's ever tried to create anything, you know, there is a struggle, isn't there? You know. And you keep wishing for something you don't have, so to speak, in order to complete the creation.
I have a image of these bad kids that are looking moon and going around thrashing each other in these tackles.
Yes, I do too. I mean, you know, really, this is quite incredible, isn't it? Well, I think I won't go into this in detail today because our time is too close to being up. I'll let you go a little bit earlier, and we'll go into a little more detail next week and pursue this matter that HPB calls Nature Unaided Fails. Incidentally, those of you who are reading anything in Ashish, Man, Son of Man, there's a marvelous chapter which deals with this whole matter from the psychological point of view. I will be quoting from this, but if you want to read it fully, it's chapter 3 on parthenogenesis, which is, of course, virgin origin, that is, origin without fructification. And it's rather interesting how they treat it. I will be referring to that at great length, because I think they have, Prem was not involved really, except in a very introductory way, with the writing of this second volume. But I think Ashish has hit on a very important factor in taking up the fact that these watermen, terrible and bad, are part of our ancestral heritage, and indeed are often still within us. You know, not just on Halloween, Betty, but you know, but at other times. And we create them out of the elements of our own past. So.